Hello, everyone. Today, I am very excited to welcome my guest. First, a little bit of introduction. He is the creator and creator of the Technically Art newsletter, which is very well known in the technical art and real-time VFX community. You've probably seen his work on Blue Sky or Twitter. But without further ado, we'll let him do the talking. Please welcome my guest today, Harry. How's it going?
Hey, hello.
Hey. So, very happy to have you today and talk about everything technical art related. But first, let's start a little bit with introductions. Tell people about you.
Yeah, of course. I'm Harry. I'm a technical and VFX artist sometimes from Greece. Currently reside in Greece, in Athens. Right now, I'm working mainly full-time with Okomotive, you know, the studio behind like the Far games and the Hurdling game that just released a few months ago. In general, I've been sharing pretty much everything I could find and do and learn around shaders and tech art and VFX and all that. And yeah, I wanted to basically create a nice little community around all the fun stuff that you can do with shaders. Nowadays I'm still kind of sharing stuff, trying to also make some assets while still working on games. That's mainly it, I think.
Perfect. How would one even get into being a technical artist? Maybe share your own journey first, and then we can go into like the path.
The multiple paths. I mean, I don't even think there are paths anymore. I think it's basically an ocean. Like a vast thing. I'll start with my case. For me in general, I was generally always curious. Even as a child, basically, I was really into computers and all that. So I even like, initially I really wanted to get into like 3D art, and I even taught myself some 3D right in middle school, I think. Back then Blender was looking really, really, really complicated. So I actually got started with a very niche 3D modeling program. It's called Animator, but like with an 8.
Okay.
And it's ridiculous. If anybody sees it speaking right now, it's ridiculous. But I mean, it had like triangles and vertices and edges. So, you know, I kind of went along with that. So I always like, you know, the idea of making 3D and making art like that. But at the same time, I was not, didn't really get the chance to get good at making art or drawing or, you know, anything more artistic in that sense. And I was also very interested in technical stuff. So I also learned coding during middle school and in high school as well. And yeah, because I did want to get into games, like I knew I wanted to do that. Like right after high school, I pretty much went into the computer science path. So I went to uni for computer science, informatics and all that. And I got a very good basis around like, you know, coding, programming, like informatics as a science, pretty much. But, you know, I also want to make games. So I taught myself how to use Unity and how to make games there. And because I still always had like this little artistic bug in me, I went back to learn more 3D in Blender this time, where it was a bit more usable. Like one thing then to another. And then I learned about, you know, shaders and technical art as a concept, like a field that combines both coding and art. So, yeah, I started getting into shaders. I think that was back in 2016, 2017. And I very quickly realized that it was a very niche subject, a very not well-known subject. Like, I remember specifically, right when I was starting with like game development, we had some actual like meetups with some local game developers here in Athens.
Yeah.
And you know, as I was, you know, still at the very far edge of the Dunning-Kruger effect, thinking that I know everything about game development and Unity, because you know, I could make some games, I could make things move and make add sounds, and I, you know, I thought I had a grasp at least on most of the basic stuff.
Yeah.
And some guy there from the meetup actually gave a little presentation about shaders, and you know, they showed some shaders, some, you know, hand coded shaders, because that's what we had back then. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, this is some code that I've never seen before in my life, and it doesn't make any sense to me. So damn, okay, there's a whole other world there. Mm-hmm. So I started learning about those. I remember, I think my first major source was actually an old Unite talk where somebody had actually did a workshop, like going through making a shader from scratch, mm-hmm. which was like magic back then. Mm-hmm. And you know, then I basically went into like a big rabbit hole searching for any resources or any, you know, people that had uploaded their shaders and trying to work out how they work. Yeah. And because I was like, okay, there are resources out there. I mean, you can find resources. You can find like Ben Goldsey's posts about shaders. But they are very, very scattered. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, you know, since I'm learning about shaders, maybe it would be useful for others to also like tag along and have like one place, like my WordPress blog space at that point, mm-hmm. Where they could actually see, you know, what I'm making, and I can go through that and hopefully help others so that they wouldn't have to go through all this trouble that I had to go through. Because, yeah, I might have to remind some people that before, yeah, in 2017, for example, all shaders in Unity were coded, hand-coded.
Yeah.
No shader graph, no
absolutely
built-in node tools. I mean, there were third-party assets like the Amplify editor or ShaderForge, mm-hmm. but like for the most part, if you want to do it, yeah, shaders, they would have to be hand-coded with CG back then, which was already deprecated back then, but still. And yeah, very weird code. So yeah, I was like, you know what, since I'm learning how to do that, I might as well help others as well.
Cool.
And yeah, that's basically set me on a path to learn more about shaders. Right after 2017, I also started working, not quite in the games industry. It was a creative agency here in Athens. They were doing like branding, communication, that kind of stuff. And they also had like some side projects with Unity that they needed some help with, for advertisement purposes or for some passion projects, basically. So like the job description was Unity developer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like Unity handler, pretty much. Not even like a programmer or an artist.
When was
that? Like
2018
That was 2017. Summer of 2017.
That was like technical art was such a niche thing. It is still niche right now. But damn, it was like I discovered that I was actually doing technical art when it was, I think, 2021. And before that, my title was always been a generalist. And then, you know, at the end of my job, basically I was going into the process of writing my CV, and I discovered, okay, now I am a technical artist is what they call it, right?
Sorry if you want to.
No, all good,
more.
All good. I noticed that I interrupted your thought, so I will. Space again.
Yeah, no, it's a good point, because I was so scared of, like, being identified as a technical artist, saying that I'm a technical artist, because you go out there, you go to Twitter back then, Blue Sky Now, and you see people who say, okay, I'm a technical artist. Here's a crazy freaking thing that you can do with like Houdini and Maya scripts and here's a casual ray tracing engine. And, you know, they're like, okay, I'm a technical artist. So I cannot think that I can share that title when I have no idea how to write scripts for Maya or do rigging and animation the way that some technical artists do.
Yeah, I
Like
think the one that
these.
intimidate a lot of people is the tool scripting. That's like,
Yeah.
it's really scary. Like, I don't want to be a tech. No, don't. I'm not a technical artist. I don't want to do that. And it's like, it's such a broad term, right?
Yeah, it is an extremely broad term. So, yeah, calling myself that was like scary. I'm like, I didn't share any of the knowledge or the skill set as, that technical artist. How can I be a technical artist?
Yeah.
But the thing is that, if you're, using tech and art and you're basically using it to make the life of your artists easier, you're a technical artist. I mean,
Also, the
that's the bottom
technical,
line.
like, you make the tech team lives also easier in a way. You're also
Yeah,
take
yeah.
like lifting heavyweight away from them as well, because I feel like a lot of tech people are intimidated when it comes to artistic or creative coding, which shaders are about. And I feel
Yeah.
like you lift a lot of that weight away from them because they really don't want to be doing that. They just want to be focused on like making the game work, making it functional, creating systems, databases, stuff like that, I feel. Of course,
Yeah.
generalizing here like is understatement.
Yeah, no, you're actually very, very correct, and that's like an aspect that I haven't really thought a lot, because coming from like the CS background, I see coders like over at automotive that they're doing crazy stuff, like
Yeah.
very complicated systems, very clean code, very yeah, and they're on the same hand. They're at the same time, they're very, scared kind of tech art stuff or shaders or art-wise stuff. And I'm like, how? You're doing like so much, much crazier stuff than what I'm doing. To be fair, yeah, I haven't really seen that side. But yeah, I'm mostly thinking about it in terms of basically making the art pipeline easier, which of course involves the tech as well, because a lot of the art or whatever, visual stuff you see on screen, they are very also informed by, the systems and the gameplay and all that. So,
So
yeah,
basically
being right in the middle.
you started as a technical artist in 2018, correct?
I guess, so I was working at that creative agency up until 20, late 2019, early 2020, where I was doing whatever then, but I also kind of started doing some freelancing as basically VFX art, but also maybe some tech art or at least some shaders. I still wasn't really calling it technical art back then.
If you, I'm just gonna say this, if you do anything with shaders, you probably are a technical artist.
Yeah, pretty
Yeah,
much. Yeah,
pretty
obviously.
much.
Yeah, since you're making shaders, I mean, that's basically shaders are a tool for artists.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm gonna just tell a short story here on the game that I worked on latest. I wanted my credits to be VFX artist, but then like literally all the team came to me and was like, "You did shaders." I was like, "Yeah." And they were like, "You're a technical artist." I was like, "Okay, I guess." And they're like, "Yeah, you are. Shut up, you are."
yeah, that tracks.
Yeah. Like, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, but yeah, I was doing some freelancing then, so I was also that way, and that's also like kind of part of like my path into the games industry and like the technical art field. Because I made some connections, then I improved my portfolio to at least with pieces that I could show, or definitely gain more experience with working with different teams, with different tasks, with different whatever anybody needed, different engines maybe. Though not so much. I think I stuck mainly with Unity. That I don't think there were a lot or any Unreal stuff. Godot was not at a good state back then.
Go
Sorry.
ahead, go ahead. I'm with you.
Yeah, so it was mostly just this not very fulfilling creative agency stuff, along with like some freelancing, which really helped me gain like more experience, more confidence, more connections. And at the same time, I was way more active with like my blogs and with sharing all the stuff that I learned or I was making. So it was like a very, very productive period. And then, after my job there at that creative agency, I had to go to like a conscription, essentially, because we have that in Greece. So I had to go to the army for like almost 1 year.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I was like, you know, for whatever it's worth, I'm pretty sure that, you know, that year was not going to be very productive for me. I was just going to be away. So that year ended up being 2020. Mm. So that was not a very productive year for the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess timing was
perfect.
Yeah. As good as one can say. But at least, yeah, after I finished with that, I also picked up some more freelancing. Mm-hmm. But because I, you know, had already shared a lot of stuff and like my job, my work was out there. Mm-hmm. And like I shown, even if I didn't have any reels or a solid portfolio, I had, you know, shared, you know, all the stuff that I was making.
Yeah, true. And yeah, which is more valuable even from a final piece, in my opinion.
If I was exactly. Writing,
I would look exactly for someone who would share how they work. Yeah,
because I mean, obviously, you know, portfolios are the go-to, right? But something that's very important, and you know, I was also getting to that in regards to like an advice for getting into the industry or tech art field in general, is that, you know, people kind of want to hire people, so you have to show that you're a person and that, you know, you're sharing your work, but you can also share your thoughts on the work or in general, or basically, you know, so some personality behind it.
Yeah, also kind like of on the
branding.
Job, like on the job, you will have excuse me. Sorry about that, people. It was a timer. Anyway, on the job, you'll have like the producer or even the art lead asking you to document things, right? I usually do it in the form of video. It seems to work. People like it. But like you're expected to be documenting. And I feel like when you have a blog or you have shared your process, that can come as a commodity even for people to hire you. They would look for things like this. I would feel if you do have that, then I would think you're more hireable. But that's just my opinion.
No, it definitely is. First off, it does show like soft skills, you know, because especially when it comes to like technical art, but I'd say all disciplines really, but maybe a little more with technical art, like communication is, you know, it's the name of the game, right?
Yep.
Because, you know, you're working with a team, and especially when it comes to technical art, that's why I'm emphasizing on that. You know, you have to talk with the whole art team. You have to decipher their needs or suggest, you know, what they might need. And then you also have to problem solve with the tech team to actually implement all the things. So
but
there's
also,
a lot of...
if I'm allowed to interrupt, like we live in a triangle, like we live in a... We don't have a team on our own. We don't have a tech art team. We also don't have a tech art lead, I guess, unless you're in, I don't know, Rockstar or like big companies, then you would find those. But we live in a triangle between production, art, and the tech team. Right, so we're constantly being communicating between those three all the time. So production would ask us, some of us, I guess, with the skills that if we could create tools for artists because they have tedious tasks, can we automate some of the things? Right, that's one section of tech art. Or let's take another section, which is visual effects. It's also considered tech art, right? We need to satisfy the production in the sense of like not taking too long with a task, and satisfy the tech in the sense of like creating the right parameters maybe, or kind of coordinating of on how like the implementation can be easier on both ends. And the art, of course, because the art lead is basically what you need to be following, especially the style and stuff like that. So back to your point, which is like we are our own department.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I had the luck and the privilege really to work with like smaller teams. So for example, right now at Akomotiv, we don't really have the producer Ed's Vertex, I guess. Because it's a small team, and I can directly, you know, communicate with both like the artists and, you know, the coders, and, you know, just straight up DM them and I'm like, I'm gonna make this, is it fine? So, but yeah, previously before that, and it was like also after conscription, so it ties in great with the previous stuff. I was working over at JumpSip, where we shipped Somerville. And we were like 30 people towards the end, maybe a bit more. And yeah, there were, we had two or three producers at some point helping with managing all the tasks and all the milestones. It was very important. Like they were doing like really great job trying to balance everything. But also at the same time, like the most stuff I did were in communication with like specific artists who were like, okay, I need something to do this. And then in most cases, that goes like for every team pretty much, but you also kind of have to decipher, like, you know, they will tell you that, okay, can we have a tool that makes a gradient and stores it in a texture for this and this? And, you know, then you'll have to go in and ask, what do you want to do? Mm-hmm. What are you trying to do? So then we can maybe discuss, you know, better solutions or, you know, do what you asked, but maybe, you know, with more context and all that. So having this sort of like soft skills and communication skills with for all that problem solving, that's very invaluable in the whole industry, but much more with tech art.
Yeah.
When you're right in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to ask you about people who are maybe intimidated by HLSL and Shader programming, such as myself. Like I am intimidated, and it's a lot of things still don't click for me. I do most of my work using graph editors, not only just in Engine. I also use Material Maker. I find myself, you know, using that program because also it can create shaders. It can generate the shaders that you create in the node graph. And they would even appear a bit more readable than the ones you would make in Unity. But back to HLSL, what would you tell a person like me who still is intimidated to do when it comes to HLSL?
Well, it definitely looks weird at first, especially if your first contact with it, like on my end, it was with Unity, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, shaders, they are with HLSL, but they're also encapsulated in like two or three more layers of different syntaxes because of how like Unity's system works. But like specifically with HLSL, I mean, if you're somewhat familiar with some coding, right? Even if that's, you know, Python or, you know, C sharp or whatnot, then, you know, the logic is there, you know, sequential commands, all that stuff.
Yeah. What if you're not though?
If you're not, that gets a bit more tricky because like a lot of the fundamentals of programming are very, you know, needed for writing code, even in HLSL. What people don't also realize is that, you know, HLSL and those languages are also very based in C, you know, the C or C++ programming language. Yeah. So they also share some interesting quirks there and some interesting syntaxes. So, you know, if you get somewhat familiar with like some coding, again, nothing crazy, just, you know, realizing, okay, that you need a variable to be declared there so that you can use it underneath it.
Yeah.
No, just the very basics of these programming rules. I think HLSL is really, or basically writing shaders in HLSL is like really, really rewarding and really fast and cool.
Right, it's performance friendly.
Not necessarily. I mean, fast mainly in terms of you making the shaders. Maybe in terms of performance as well, because, you know, some node editors, you don't really know what they're doing underneath. And there's a lot of obfuscation and a lot of abstraction, right?
Yeah.
Like, for example, in Shader Graph, for example, you have like a node for adding two numbers, right? You also have a node to make parallax occlusion mapping. One of these things is not like the other. Like the parallax occlusion mapping is much, much more expensive than an add node. And they do have like some indicators for performance and all that. But, you know, when you're just moving boxes around, you don't really think about that stuff.
Yeah.
When you end up making a straight up for loop for that parallax occlusion mapping in HLSL, and you realize that, oh, this is doing a lot of stuff,
Over and over and over again.
then you might be, a bit more cautious as to how you're going about
This
some.
goes back also to like basic programming, right? Like if you have maybe got stuck in a loop before when you were coding a game or whatever, and you had to fix it, you were probably more aware of that going into HLSL, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like when you have like the code in front of you and you realize exactly what it's doing, like there are, in general, with coding and programming and graphics and computers, things are can be very, very nuanced. Like the order where you add or multiply some stuff can be can even have an impact on performance. Even if they don't have that doesn't have an impact on the numbers. It might have on the performance. It's like there's a lot of nuance there.
So,
You...
this kind of takes me to the point of like self-learning. You are obviously learn you're a self-learner, correct? Like
Yeah.
other than the university stuff, right, where you have got like proper education on tech and probably you did some coding, right? In there. What would you say to someone who is just like completely on the self-learning route right now, right? Like no university, they can probably do effects and shaders, but they don't know how to make it interactable. I think in the scene, in the artwork that we're looking at right now, you had this water and where the boat is over it and it was interacting with it, right? I see myself right now at the level where I know how to make the water, but I don't know how to make the boat interact with it. So, where would you advise to look into?
Well, it's not a great answer, but literally anywhere, in a
Anywhere, right?
sense, anywhere. Yeah, well,
Game dev.
so the process for me mostly was really, I would just, scroll through, social media, mostly Twitter again back then. I guess now Blue Sky is also a great place for it. And I'd see something that I was like, oh, that's so cool. How would one make that? And then, you start maybe digging a bit around and figuring out that, for example, what I did for that boat, for example, that was like some buoyancy kind of stuff. So you'd look into that. In my specific case, I those that water was made, with Gerstner waves, for example. You're probably familiar with those. It's like a classic ocean simulation stuff. It's not the best or the most fancy, but it's there. It's used a lot. So that's also a benefit of using HLSL. So those Gerstner waves for the shader were made with HLSL, right? But like code is code. So the code that was used for the Gerstner waves, I straight up copied and pasted it over in C Sharp, changing some syntax stuff, but it was still code. And that way, in the same way that, with the water, you can say that vertex goes there, then you can say that the boat's position goes there using the same exact calculations.
Yeah, of course, the position and the rotation, because if it's just position, it will look like floating in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And then, that's where you kind of do some tricks, and you basically, as I'm also calculating the normals for the waves, the normals is the perpendicular vector, so that's also where the boat would be pointing. So that's how you rotate using the normal.
Yeah,
Obviously.
that's like where coding goes a bit more into direction of mathematics. So when it comes
Oh, yeah,
to that,
absolutely.
where do you advise a lot of people start? Like vector calculations or?
Yeah, absolutely. So my first stop, both for me and I think for others, is the Book of Shaders. It's a website. I don't know if you know by the.
We will leave it in the link in the
Yeah.
description for sure.
I can't remember the name now. I also have like his deck with a Shader tarot cards. Anyway, yeah, Patricio Gonzalez. And yeah, so there are a lot of chapters there about very basic linear algebra, which sounds scary. But honestly, it's just vectors, vector math. And even those, you don't really need to know very, very in depth, right? You can, as long as you grasp like some very, very key concepts, like the dot product, the magnificent dot product that's used in everything. Or, you know, even some functions of the cross product of vectors, which is also like really cool. Like,
those are
you
all
can
concepts
get...
that are still like, I feel myself like I could learn. But if you were to explain them, like right now, quickly to people who don't understand what a dot product is, how would you explain it?
So assuming you have like two vectors, so two arrows going like this, right? The dot product essentially tells you, it expresses the relation toward in regards to like how they're pointing each other, right? So if you have like two vectors that are going the same direction, like this, right? So this, it's, the camera is mirrored, so that's but basically, you know, when they're in the same direction, the dot product could give you a number of one. Dot product just returns a single value going.
So it's kind of calculating how parallel they are to each other.
They're not. It's not calculating that, but it can tell you that.
I could tell.
What it's essentially calculating is like the projection of one vector on another. So like if they're like this, it will give you like it's kind of tough to explain with fingers. But mathematically, it's just essentially like the length of each vector multiplied by each other and by the cosine of their angle. So that's the mathematical expression.
So
but
you could use that for anything. You could make a Vine generator or whatever, right?
Like anything. Like it's also very handy if you want to check if your player is looking towards an enemy or the other way around. In general, you can check whether something is looking towards something.
Or like if a car, for example, lands on the bottom, you know, in the rotation wise, right? If the arrow of the top of the car is landing on the top, it will explode. If it's landing on the wheels, it continues, or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what you can do the dot product with. It's also why it's the basis of all shading, like the classic.
Okay.
Yeah, the classic Lambert shading, for example. You know, where you know, assuming you have like a little sphere, and you're like, okay, the light is coming from over there, so you know that this side is lit. You're essentially checking, you're checking if that side is looking towards the light.
So it's also the basic of cell shading in a way, right? You're basically manipulating the value of the dot or how close the light is to the dot product and creating the grayscale like transition.
But cell shading is basically taking that kind, just the dot product, like the Lambert shading, but instead, because you know, when you have a spherical surface, for example, you can have some areas that are almost facing away from the light, right? So they still get a little bit of light, but not entirely. Yes. With cell shading, you can be like, okay, I don't care if it's a little lit or, you know, just a little bit. I'm like, I just care if it's lit or unlit.
Yeah.
So you just do like a little step function on that dot product and you're like, okay, if it's above, you know, zero, it's lit, I don't care.
Got it. Of course, there's also more tricks to cell shadings than that, because you can. It will also look very weird if the mesh is not optimized for cell shading.
Yeah, there's a lot of magic that goes into it. That's also why you can see that. I mean, there are a lot of games that use cell shading, and some are looking amazing, but others, you know, they look maybe a little more generic or as if they're not really using it to its maximum potential. And then, you know, there are other tricks you can do, but in the same field. For example, Fresnel, right? Fresnel is also a dot product, by the way.
Yep.
But it's instead of using like light and normals, you're using U-direction and normals.
U-direction to the mesh itself. And those that are away gets the effect, or gets the mesh, basically, the white to black. Which you could also manipulate with power node or contrast or whatever to make it look more, you know, how to say,
more pronounced or like more tight in an area. And that's also like a dot product. So if at the same, in the same way you know, clamp it and do like a step on it, like with the lighting I mentioned, then you get like a tough rim, you know, a very pronounced, like specific rim light at the end.
You know, I'm curious about something. You mentioned you did a lot of freelancing, right? So you probably find yourself in a position at one point where you're maybe said yes too much to so many jobs, like two to three, maybe at a time. How do you still find room for improvement? More, higher bid. How do you find time for improvement and where you don't feel stuck in the thing that you're constantly being hired for? So basically, what I'm trying to ask is like, how do you prevent this from happening, that the thing that you're really good at gets what gets you hired, but then at one point you might get bored or feel stuck?
Luckily, I don't think I've gotten to that point yet. It's always fun. With freelancing at some point, especially right after conscription, because I also had some time in between, like as I was in conscription, to get some freelancing work done. I got like I was basically saying yes to everybody. That was a mistake in a lot of ways. It was also like to some degree it was cool because exactly I got to work with different teams and do different stuff. Like some wanted something more realistic, some wanted something more stylized. So it did give me quite a bit of variety in terms of the stuff I had to do, which definitely kept things interesting. And at the same time, as I was still finding stuff out and experimenting and making little scenes, making little stages and all that, I was also doing the stuff I wanted to do and make and share and all that. So yeah, I don't think I ever got to the point where I was like even when working in Herlin, for example, that was like a 3 year duration. I never really felt as if I was bored to work on it. It was never exciting. It was very exciting in most cases, but it was never, you know, it wasn't always exciting. That's what I'm trying to say. There were some cases where it was very frustrating, especially with like bigger systems or like more important visual systems, like the Animal Fair or DRAS, all that stuff. Always wanted to touch up or had some problems. But at least, you know, I never felt like was like, oh, okay, still gotta work on this and all that. I think and you know, obviously I cannot say for any other technical artist, but the nature of the field is also so enticing and so, you know, there's always problems to solve, where it's kind of tough to get into like a routine, a very tiresome routine. There will always be some not as exciting stuff, like for example, writing documentation, which as you mentioned is like a big part of it. I also not very much enjoy, but you know, when I get to write documentation for some tools and all that, I try to make it as detailed as, you know, clear and all that. But you know, it's a not as fun
Exciting,
process.
I feel like that title being so broad is both a blessing here and it could go against you in the sense of like, okay, what do I learn now? And the answer is like everything. But the reality is that you can't learn everything unless you have a job or two or three or five that require you to learn everything specifically to solve a problem that you're facing. So it's almost like the role is you could only know technical art if you are hired to do something with the abilities that you have, but also expand on it. Which is makes it super weird to navigate to become a technical artist. Like I feel now, me as a visual effects artist, like real-time VFX artist and slash technical artist, I'm getting to that level where I'm like dipping my toes into like, all right, so what is the dots product, right? Because I'm slowly getting into that level of working enough on enough projects to say, okay, I'm needed for different things, right? And that is hard as someone. I guess that my train of thought should end here as like, people see technical artist and they start searching the term technical artist to educate themselves about technical art. But it is a byproduct of game development. It is not a skill you go to university. Maybe there is a university section now these days that teaches you that exactly. But it's a byproduct of game development to begin with, right?
Would you agree? Yeah, for sure. I would say that, again, while, you know, studios and projects are looking for technical artists as a role or as a title, the field itself, or, you know, being a technical artist, I'd say it's more of a mindset rather than a skill set.
Yeah.
It obviously has like a baseline of skills in terms of, you know, you're making shaders. That's a very classic thing that you would expect from a technical artist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the idea is that, you know, you are making stuff that help, you know, the tech and the art in a project and all that, shaders is the most common way to do that, but obviously there are others as well. Yeah. Tools, Houdini, scripting, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But the idea is that if, because, you know, it's honestly more of a mindset to learn stuff and learn how to use that stuff to, you know, in a most efficient manner to help your team. Mm-hmm. The skills themselves, you know, when they get a bit more nuanced at least, mm-hmm. they don't matter what they are. Mm-hmm. They matter in the sense that they are handed to you, that they might be needed by a team, mm-hmm. but it's not, you know, I wouldn't say that, okay, I've seen technical artists do rigging, for example, skinning and rigging
yep.
for animation. Going after it and being like, okay, then I have to learn rigging and animation and skinning and all that is maybe not the most helpful way to go about it.
Yep.
I'd say that basically growing your skill set mm-hmm. as a technical artist is more of something that you kind of stumble upon mm-hmm. as you're being more curious and trying more stuff yeah. and trying to learn whatever you find. Like at yep. one point, I also got into like that little book that's like ray tracing in a weekend. I don't know if you've seen that.
Cool. All right.
Yeah. It's a very
description.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember the author's name again. But yeah. The idea is that you're writing a ray tracer in C++ without any graphics API. Doing it on the CPU. You're straight up outputting the colors on the text file. Huh. But it still, it still works, and you still learn some stuff from it, and you can then be like, okay, cool. Now I want to make that work with compute shaders. Hmm. You know, if you want, you can go ahead and do that. I say that what worked for me a lot was, you know, as I was scrolling everywhere and, you know, seeing stuff and how other people made stuff, I basically made like mental notes, mental asterisks of. You know, somebody would share some really cool clouds, for example, and they'd say, oh, those are ray marched and whatever. Mm. And then I would look up, okay, what is ray marching? And then I would be like, oh, damn, this is tough. That makes no sense whatsoever. But then, you know, after however many years, honestly, you'd go back to ray marching and you'd be like, oh, so that's what it is. And then I can make something like that. Like that was pretty much almost the exact experience with me and actually Ray Martin. Mm. Like when I started with shaders, I was watching like volumetric lighting, you know, like sun rays going through windows and all that. And I'm like, how? I only know how to do like a dissolve shader, for example. Mm. Like how does that even work? How do you add volume to a scene? Like it doesn't make sense, right?
So in a way, the environment you were surrounding yourself daily, even on the sense of like browsing on social media, was a good environment in the sense of it's not distracting you and you're constantly passively learning in a way. Right.
In a sense, yeah, obviously there would be like some, toxic mentality on it, as in
Comparing
like,
yourself?
yeah, of course, yeah, or seeing some amazing artists that are like 18, 20 years old when you're like 25 and they're doing crazy stuff and you're like, okay, why can I not do that? There's gonna be a bit like this. There's always also gonna be a bit of an imposter syndrome that doesn't really ever go away. But if you still see cool stuff and you're like, oh, cool, I would like to make something like that. And you kind of go into different rabbit holes, even if you don't understand anything about what's going on, right? You don't understand the math behind it. They link you to a paper and everything looks gibberish. By the way, I still cannot really decipher like graphics papers and pretty much figure out what they're talking about half or all the time, really. So I usually go by searching for repositories where people have, uploaded their work and kind of try to reverse engineer stuff. And again, especially when starting out, you will not be understanding a lot of stuff or any stuff really. But just knowing that there's a thing out there called ray marching, that there's a thing out there called froxels, like frustum aligned voxels, that kind of stuff, and knowing very broadly what you could do with them, then in a few months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, in my case, honestly, if I start in 2017, it got me 6 or 7 years to figure out ray marching.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I wasn't constantly trying to understand it, obviously, but I just learned other stuff. I learned how you could use the depth buffer to do cool stuff, or how you could recreate wall space positions and whatnot. So when you have a grasp on some of those elements, then you can be like, oh, so now I can do ray marching.
Here's the thing, like rendering can be, especially like real-time rendering, can be such a hard task to understand, right? What resources have you found, or practices or challenges that you've put on yourself that have helped you understand it? And have you ever understood it fully, or do you find yourself going back and looking it up?
Yeah, I definitely don't think I have fully understood it. It's a very vast, like very, very complicated part. Definitely something that did help me was, a little bit of graphics background from the computer science uni days. But it was just a single module that had like some graphics there. Then, at some point, maybe once or twice, maybe thrice, I even tried to make like a game engine from scratch, where you basically start with like the graphics backend and that kind of stuff. It always like fell apart by the second or third video, by the way. I never really did it, but at least I got a grasp of how graphics are pushed over to like the GPU. And I was constantly seeing that little diagram where you see like all the different steps that the GPU is going to render something, like from the input assembler, vertex shader, then the mysterious in between shaders, like the geometry shaders and the tessellation shaders and all those niche shaders before
Niche,
going
you
over
say,
to
huh?
where before going into like the fragment shader and you get the pixel. Right. So it I
Okay, can I pause here for a second? Which shader is the most expensive?
well the fragment shader, I'd say like
The
by
last one.
default, because no matter how big of a mess or how dense of a 3D mesh you have, it would very rarely have more vertices than pixels on the screen, right?
Interesting. And so when you're looking into optimizing, do you see yourself pulling back a layer, or I guess I'm confused by how many layers there are, right? Like, and how would I know, like, all right, which one is for which use? Maybe you can share a little bit about that.
As in shaders or like like general optimization stuff.
Shaders, let's talk about it. Let's keep it in the shaders.
Yeah, well, for shaders, I mean, to be fair, in most cases, when you're working with shaders, you're gonna be working either with like the vertex shader and the fragment shader, right?
Yep.
The other ones, the other programmable stages are about like geometry shaders, which are controversial, apparently.
Okay.
In the sense that they're not very performant. They're not supported in some APIs. So they were kind of a cool idea, but I feel that somewhere along the way they kind of fell apart.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm gonna stop here for a second. Okay. What's confusing for me is like when you say, all right, geometry shader or vertex shader, how are you accessing those? Like with InCode, you're saying, I want to affect that shader? What's an API?
Well, the API is a bit broader because it ha also has to do, with like how the objects are loaded into the GPU and how like you pass over like the camera matrices, all that stuff, right? But and the shader pipeline is basically a subset of, that API. It runs on that API, but it's like a thing on its own. So for the other shaders, well, that's, for example, if you're writing Unity shaders, right, by hand, right? So that's HLSL stuff. So if you let me get go like one step above, actually. So when you're mostly working with Unreal, right?
No, I work with Unity.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, I've seen you also work with Unreal, so I mean, I
Yep,
can bring
I
some
do. I do.
examples from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the Material Editor, for example, and that also goes for like the Unity shader graph, you are actually making both a vertex and a fragment shader. That's what you're
Okay.
creating.
Yeah.
It's a bit abstracted. Unity has it a bit less abstracted. In Unreal, it's much less abstracted. For example, you have like your big output node and you have like your color and all that. And there's also like a little node, a little single node that's called WPO, right? World Position Offset, which is to do like waves and all that on meshes. That's actually something that runs on your vertex shader. So it's obfuscated. You don't have to know that, but it makes sense, right? You're modifying the positions of your vertices at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So that's something that's hidden from you, but it's actually running on the vertex shader.
That is interesting. That maybe that's why for me it's so difficult to understand like how do I access a certain pipeline of rendering, right? Because as you're saying, it's abstract and it's not telling you exactly what it's doing. Yet you find yourself oftentimes not being able to hook like the node with the other node because maybe something the developers have disabled in the project because of like performance and other stuff, right?
It's mostly because some stuff are not available from stage to stage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
Okay.
for example, yeah, maybe that's a bit technical, but
No, go ahead.
yeah. So, mipmaps, right?
Yeah.
So the way that they work and the way that they are picked
Yeah.
essentially is by taking out the derivatives between the rendered pixels.
Yep.
All right. So, little fun fact. GPUs actually render pixels in a 2x2 quad, a pixel quad.
All right.
It's not, they don't actually go pixel by pixel. They do
Interesting.
it in groups of four.
And
And the reason they
that
do.
is being green, blue, red, and what
No,
the other?
just like four pixels each time. Each
Four
pixel
pixels.
has its
Okay.
own.
Okay.
Yeah, each pixel has its own color, but like they're in groups of
Got
four
it.
instead
Got
of
it.
like one by one.
Because there's a
And
term for the exact pixel as well, right? It's used in pixel art. Like the exact
yeah.
color. What is that called? I
No,
forgot.
it's just the fragment color or.
Yeah, maybe. Go ahead. Continue. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. So the reason it's doing that nowadays, or at least, part of why it's handy, is that they can actually do a little bit of comparison between those four pixels and figure that, oh, okay, the pixel that you're currently looking at, for example, if you sample a texture there, it's going to be very noisy and very blurry, for example, because it's like very close together. The Texans are very close together or something.
Okay.
So that way you're going to pick a larger MIP level, which is basically a lower resolution version of that texture, mm-hmm. so that then you can avoid like the noise and all that, right? So this is something that needs to happen in the pixel shader, the fragment shader state. And this is why you don't have access to those if you want to like use them in a vertex shader scenario. That's also why you might have seen that in shader graph. When you're trying to sample a texture to do like vertex offset.
Okay.
If you try to use like the sample texture 2D node, and plug the output in the vertex position,
yeah.
it won't let you.
It won't let you, yeah.
Because by default, the sample texture 2D, like the default action of that, is to also sample the MIP levels to grab you the best version of that.
All right, got
so
it.
So that's yeah. why you have to use the LOD
yeah.
version.
Okay. All right. All of that makes sense.
All of that stuff is there, very, very explicit in coding and in HLSL. And that's why it's also very handy to dig more into the coded part of it.
Yeah.
Because then you can see all that stuff in front of you.
I think the hurdle of making anything in HLSL is being able to see how cool it is quickly. Because
yeah.
literally every freaking course tutorial is showing you how to make something super basic and boring that I just lose interest immediately, because they mm-hmm. always show you like, oh, this is how you make a sign with a time and you multiply it, and it's like, I don't know how to do that in Node Graph, you know, like I don't want to do that. But I feel like if there was something in a video format and not just like text format that would actually show you something really cool with HLSL that is also simple, like, I feel like that's missing. But I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, that's actually a good point, because I'd say that this is like a big, a very, very big gap. Mm. Honestly, if you want to go like hand, you know, with handwritten, hand-coded shaders
yeah.
in Unity, for example, in order to get something really, really cool and unique, but also that's not complex, yeah, I think that's pretty impossible. it would have to use a lot of math.
Yeah.
And also, and that's the annoying part of it.
Yeah.
Like writing shaders in Unity to, for example, make them work with lighting, with receiving shadows, with casting shadows.
Yeah.
With multiple additional lights, with, I don't know, ambient lighting, reflections, ambient prop, all of that stuff, it's a very heavy layer of code
yeah.
that you'd have to dig through a bunch of big files to figure out where they are and what they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, for example, in URP, right, that's the main pipeline I use nowadays. I'm saying it like that because I used to be a big advocate for the built-in render pipeline and very much hated URP.
You can do a lot of cool stuff with even like the basics of the URP and the built-in.
Yeah, no, nowadays URP is actually really, really great. It still lacks the great thing that used to be surface shaders that we had in the built-in. I don't know, have you used like, surface
shaders? I never really played with surface shaders before.
So that's also like maybe part of, you know, that might have been something that would help you get more into handwritten shaders.
Yeah.
Because the idea with surface shader, which it was a great idea, and honestly, super weird that they did not like continue that with the render pipelines, is that it is hand coded, right? It is using HLSL.
All right.
But it is very abstracted, right? Mm-hmm. So you could have cell shading, you could have weird shading models, lighting models, that kind of stuff, without needing to rewrite all of that tedious code regarding shadow casting, lights, all of that. No, you would just, you know, you could just change, for example, how the color of the texture is, you know, mapped, or you could do like a little lerp between two textures, maybe using vertex colors, all of that stuff, without having to write a bunch of boilerplate code, because that's also the annoying thing, as you mentioned, with like seeing what people could do with HLSL shaders. There's a lot of boilerplate code in order to make it work with the engine and the environment. That's why most of the examples you'll see would be simple, and they would be simple sine waves or some procedural shapes, like the book of shaders that I mentioned. It's really cool. It's interactive. It's GLSL instead of HLSL, but honestly, same difference. And you know, you wouldn't really see any really, 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 really cool stuff because it is API or engine agnostic, basically. It's just the logic of shaders. But, you know, you don't have any environment to put it into, to interact with lights and all that. When you go over in Unity and you want to access all of that stuff, then basically you have to kind of integrate with all of the other stuff. And that's a lot of code, a lot of boilerplate code. You end up having to write a bunch of stuff until you see something working on the screen the way you want it to. And that's a major hurdle in getting into writing shaders.
So it was easier before they discontinued it, right? The surface shader, I mean.
Sure, come again.
So you said surface shader is not continued anymore, right?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, so it was probably easier to get into HLSL back then.
It did help because it obfuscated a lot of stuff, I guess now that they didn't deem it necessary to continue it because you have shader graph, which is, you know, a much, much bigger abstraction.
Pretty much.
So you don't even need to write anything.
Yeah.
And I guess I get it, but at the same time, it also restricts you a lot. Like, for example, tessellation, right? That's something that currently URP, for example, cannot do with shader graph. You would have to write it by hand. And it's not even that complicated. It used to be, with surface shader, you could write literally three, or I might be exaggerating, so I'll say four lines of code, and you would have tessellation.
So those four lines you would be basically pulling from what the engine was doing already, and abstraction in a way. Like you're taking the parameters that the engine outputted for you, so you don't have to do all the calculations yourself in a way, right?
Exactly. It basically tells the engine, okay, I want the shader to also use tessellation in that way. You know, it had some parameterization in terms of how you use it, but you know, you could still do that. And by the way, minor tangent, but because I also mentioned that before, in Unreal Engine, you could also like do a little drop down and say, oh, use tessellation, right? That tessellation is actually also a shader. It's also a hidden shader. It's actually usually composed of two shaders, the hull and domain shader. Very, very obfuscated, very, very abstracted. You might not even ever, I mean, I haven't even written a domain shader in my life. It's not hard because they're not doing much. They're mostly used for tessellation, so they're kind of, you know, structured to do that. But yeah, that's also another obfuscated thing.
All right, so I'll ask you that question. I like to ask my guests when they are skilled in something that I don't fathom as much as I would love to. If you have a time machine and you went 7 years backwards, maybe 10 years backwards, what is the thing you would put on a USB drive and take for yourself in the past as a resource? It could be a book, it could be a tutorial, it could be a YouTube channel, it could be anything.
That's a good question. I think a lot, I mean, some of those videos might be that old, but like Sebastian Lake's videos are great for some of that stuff. Like those were some of the videos that really got me into understanding, for example, ray matching, as I mentioned. Otherwise, honestly, maybe some of my own projects. Because And that's also something that people might not have in mind, but I don't have all the knowledge at the top of my head,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I constantly...
You have a library.
I constantly go back and forth in my own projects. Like I might just once implement something from like some tutorial, you know, cannibalized code and all that together.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after that, I just, you know, copy and paste that stuff and modify it as I go. But, you know.
Your job becomes more of a manager of like those different solutions that you kind of figured out by time. That's the position I find myself in a lot of the time, especially with VFX. It's like you're not going to create a hit effect every time. You kind of know what it is about. You just maybe create different textures or you create different flipbooks. But you're kind of reusing, you're cannibalizing a lot of the old work. So yeah, that's a good answer, actually. I was very impressed by that answer. Yep.
Because a lot of resources, I think I lost at this point, like some bookmarks and some repositories that I found in the past. I have no idea how to search for them again, but you know, I had implemented stuff from that, so I could go back on my projects and, you know.
All right, so does it help you to have an idea of something you really want to do? So like the ramen thing, like I guess you were curious on how that would look like, right? So that was your initial thought to do the research, or was it flipped? Was it that you learned a skill, then you applied it on the ramen scene? How does it work usually?
I think it always works like the first way you mentioned. So I always have something in mind that I want to make or recreate or try and make. Like, for example, now it's playing like the Blade Runner light thing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a little bit of both, actually, but in most cases, it's like, okay, I want to make this, right? Mm. This effect, this, whatever. And then, you know, go and break it down. Okay, for example, for the ramen, I would need, you know, to do cell shading or try to make it look more like a 2D anime thing, right?
Yeah.
So that's a good, nice label to look into, right? To search for cell shading.
Yeah.
In that case, I already knew about cell shading. I actually used a shader that I had made a tutorial on, and it's on my blog, for example. In general, the idea is, I want to make something, research the individual steps and find resource on that thing. In the case of the ramen, it was actually a challenge in my server. We used to have these, there was some, they used to be maybe monthly or bi-weekly or something. It was kind of a mixed frequency there because I'm lazy.
I get it.
It's tough managing a community along with every other thing. I think the theme was food or maybe anime food.
Right.
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, it would be cool to try and make something that kind of looks like an anime ramen kind of thing. So, you know, grabbed a bunch of references. I think one of them was like the ramen from Ponyo, the Ghibli movie. Glad to hear that. I mean, that was the main reaction. Oddly enough, it was the more popular part of that ramen gif was not the original one itself, because maybe, you know, as you scroll by, you might even think that it was. It's from an anime, so you don't think too much about it.
Yeah.
It was a gif below that, like a response to that, where I I grabbed the broth disc, which is it's just a little mess, just a circular mess.
Yeah.
And I grab it and flip it around to show that it's actually 3D. And that's actually what got the most attention, because it was, I guess, funny to be like, okay, I'm taking your broth away.
Yeah. Awesome. So it's always something you want to replicate visually in a 3D world or in an engine that kind of gets you into the research. Because I would think it's a bit like cooking, right? You don't go around and learn how to fry necessarily or how to boil something, because you can boil a potato, right?
Yeah.
But it's the same concept of boiling that can get you to something delicious like making your spaghetti or whatever, right? Like boiling noodles, then you learn how to fry some onions and some whatever, some beef, and you add tomato sauce to that. Then the mix of all of that that kind of gets you the recipe. And I feel like if we stop thinking about technical art as like this HLSL and sine and cosine, and start thinking about it more like game dev, and I really want to make this type of game, or I really want to make this game that is so focused on visuals, right? Maybe it's as simple as Candy Crush, right? I think if we start thinking about technical art like that, we will be closer to it than if we think about it as in the term itself. I feel like those are the furthest people to what technical art actually is, which is...
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And actually, the cooking metaphor is pretty apt for this because, yeah, as you mentioned, like you also said, like that there's also another way that, you know, you learn about something and then you're thinking of things to apply it to, right?
Yeah.
So it also goes kind of like that, right? So, you know, great way to start is, you know, think about something you want to make or recreate and look into making that. And as you're doing that, you learn, for example, about cell shading.
Yeah.
And then when you know about cell shading and let's say Gerstner waves, for example,
yeah,
you're like, okay, how would a cell shaded ocean look? And that's also on my reel. It's probably going to come in soon.
Cool.
So you end up actually combining all the stuff that you've learned or you've tried before, and you find out new stuff, and then goes on forever and ever and ever. Like, I don't have it in that video, for example, but when I was playing with like clouds and ray marching, at the same time, I was also playing again with like ocean waves with Gerstner waves.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to try the stupidest thing ever. Mm-hmm. And I made a literal ocean of clouds running on Gerstner waves. It ran at 3 frames per second.
Yeah.
very, very, very silly. But it was an idea.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you do go on to make whatever you want. So the idea is it is going to approach, you know, stuff that you want to recreate, something that somebody else had made or something from a game, something from the movie. Any sort of inspiration you can find whatsoever.
Yeah.
Try to make that or recreate that. But it's just the individual steps.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes inspiration can be with your own work that you're doing. Like one of the things that I made recently is like, I started looking up what flow maps are because the project I was working on, they have a solution that was made through flow maps, right? And then I understood, okay, green means it goes that direction. Red means it goes that direction. All right. Sorry, everyone. Recording stopped. All right. Where were we? I forgot.
Yeah, I think I forgot as well.
All right. So here's... I'm gonna take it from here. No worries. Oftentimes, I find myself... Oh, we were talking about the flow maps, actually. So green goes this way. Red goes that way. But the people that I was working with, they used static textures. So the red and the green were painted. And then the flow map took care of like the what it does, right? Which is panning the texture in a way that makes it look like it's moving. And I was like, what if the red and the green is being controlled on their own and they're animating all the time? So I created a very, very cool looking shader, like a very realistic looking shader. And I was so proud of that. It's pretty much like it's been done before, but I was like, I'm proud. I was like, wow. I had no idea about the flow map, but right now I'm doing something really cool with the flow map.
Yeah, that's it, honestly. That's all there is to it. Like getting to use something that you didn't know about, you learn about it, and then, you know, once you have a grasp of it, you're like, okay, but how could I do what would happen if I did this?
Yeah.
And then you learn about that kind of stuff. And then you can layer it, combine it. At the end of the day, I think the most viable, I'm laughing because it's kind of silly, but the most viable lesson with technical art is that nothing matters. everything is arbitrary and vague, and we just give it meaning by conventions. I don't know if you know the Game Collective. It's a Discord server
Oh, it's
for
a
like.
huge server. Like, I can't keep up with those huge servers. Like 30,000 people or something.
No, I don't think it's because it's kind of recent. It was mostly made to help people with mentorships and all that
Yeah, I think
from
I've had
industry layers.
one of the creators on Manos. I think he's there. He's pretty
Oh
active.
yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Anyway.
So I did a little talk there
Yeah,
about
cool.
UVs basically and
Yeah.
how UVs as because the texture the server is mostly artist focused, right? With 3D artists and all that.
Yep.
So you learn about UVs as being the thing that you use to map textures,
Yeah.
and you leave it at that. And then this whole talk was about that it's not. It's essentially just a bunch of interpolated values across vertices. So you can use them
True.
to bake data, to bake pivots.
That's true.
You can remake the UV coordinates using vertex colors. At some point, I actually like took a screenshot of like the UV space, like the gradient, red, green,
Yeah.
that UV thing.
Yep.
And I used that texture mapped with vertex colors and used that as a map for UV coordinates.
Wow.
Because UVs are just numbers and
Yep.
they don't matter,
Yeah, if
really.
you look into the FATs, right? Like the exports you can get from Embergen, they're basically
Yeah.
utilizing a bit of that, right?
But for example, are exactly a great example of that because you're basically storing vertex positions on the texture.
Yeah.
So, what you thought was, just like the position that is, that's the mess, right? You get the mess exported. Maybe you can do a little wobble in the vertex shader, and that's about it. Then you get VATS, which
It's
is
crazy.
position stored in a texture,
Yep,
and that's
it's
like crazy.
crazy what you can store in a texture. Like it's
Yeah.
textures basically were used to look at something, but then the
Yeah.
technology behind it, like the R, the G, like the red, the greens, the blue, can store so much information.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, they're just numbers. And if you go further, at the end of the day, they're just bits and bytes.
Yeah, and
So,
we're
yeah.
such visual creatures that we made so much optimization. We put so much effort into optimizing textures and sizes of textures that now this becomes in handy, right?
Yeah.
For the fats or whatever. Wow, man, this is so
Yeah.
fascinating.
Like, for example, something, again, a bit more technical, but like also fascinating is Froxels, if you're familiar, like the Frostum-aligned voxels. They basically, it's a way to do like some sort of volumetric fog and lighting. That's what I'm
Yeah,
using
for
in
water as
the
well.
app.
Water simulation, they use voxels, right? In Embergen, oh, in Liquigen as
Oh
well, they
yeah.
use the
Yeah,
voxels.
voxels in general are used a lot for any simulation really because they're essentially 3D. You can store them in 3D textures,
Oh,
right?
okay, all right, yeah.
Yeah, you can think of a voxel like a volumetric element, like a little cube instead of a pixel.
Yeah.
So instead of pixels stored in 2D textures, images, you
Yep.
have voxels stored in 3D images,
Wow.
3D buffers. So one cool thing that like volumetric fog utilizes with those like
Yeah.
3D textures is that because they are textures, they are actual textures, when you're sampling them, you're also taking advantage of the linear sampling between the froxels. So they kind of interpolate on their own
Gotcha.
because they're textures, but you're using them not as textures, but as volumes. That's also something you can see a lot with with VADs, with VATs, right? You can bake an animation of a skinned mesh, and you can actually bake it into such a low resolution. You can I've even done it like 1 frame per second instead of 60. But the thing is, you store 1 frame in one color, another frame in a second color. But because they are stored in textures, when you're sampling a texture, it's using bilinear interpolation, right? So it's interpolating between the one color and the other color. But in that case, you're interpolating between one position and another position.
Exactly.
So you end up doing interpolated motion.
Yep. And it's like it's the same concept of like 3D animation, right?
Exactly.
Like frame,
second
frame. Yeah. You could have it in steps, right? Where it goes frame one, frame 15, it snaps into it, or you can do the interpolation of like, all right. And then you can change the curves and everything. I'm not sure if you could do that here as well.
In that case, no, because exactly it's linear. So it's as if you do have a curve, but it's not really a curve. It's really
just
a flat line. But it's still something that allows you to make an animation much, much smaller.
But could you not maybe like export frame one as a color and then I'm just talking abstract here, right? Like frame two as a second color and then have a blend node or blend function that would do it as you would like it to, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. For example, you could something you can do is a classic thing when you're using curves in Unity, for example. You might want to use them in your shader, but like curves, animation curves is a C sharp concept, a Unity object concept, right? You cannot really shaders by default don't have a support for curves. So what you can do is you can bake that curve into a little gradient texture.
All right.
It's just a flat gradient, right?
Yeah.
Where you have, you know, your whole
black being
animation
zero,
object.
White being one, right?
Exactly. So you can map this curve in the gradient texture and then use that. You sample that linearly, but because you get a non-linear curve from it, from the gradient, you can use that value to interpolate between the frames.
Yeah, I would think there is a website for that, but if there's not, someone should capitalize on it. You know, where it changes your curve into a gradient and you could take the gradient as a texture? That could be a cool website.
honestly, it's something that I think I've made a little tool like that. It's really, really easy to
it's
make.
Easy, easy,
I might even have, it's basically in the same way that you can bake like gradients. Unity gradients into texture. There's also like ways to do like some procedural curves using math.
Man.
So you can still do like some mathematical. Basically, if you can express any curve, you know, in a mathematical function, you can also replicate it in shader without needing to bake. But if you have something more complex and you really, really cannot be bothered to replicate the math behind it, might as well make it in the texture.
Wow. Like this, we can go for hours on
things
like that because they're just so fascinating. All right, man. It's been great having you on. Before we go, I ask all my guests the same questions. If you know you have anything to promote or anything you would still like to add, now is the chance.
All right, three things, first off, check out Locomotives Games. Hurdling is really cool. I had a lot of fun working on it. And we just announced a new little game, the Pinkeep one. It's extremely fun. It's very, very tough playtesting it because I end up like playing a lot. So I end up forgetting to check what I want to check. Second thing is I also have like a little asset, which is for volumetric fog. It's called Haze. It's currently also 50% off for the New Year's sale, which is cool. And third one, because we did not touch on that subject, and maybe for the best, because that would last three more hours. Long story short, if you're really interested in learning about technical art and VFX and basically learning, don't use ChatGPT and AI and all that stuff. It's much, much more rewarding looking into stuff on your own. You might stumble upon things you didn't think were handy, but you still kind of take a little note of them. Honestly, I would be half the technical artist I am now if I had, if I relied on tools like that.
That's a really great advice. Because you don't know what you don't know, and when you're always asking the specifics and you're getting the specifics back half-assed baked, right? Because ChatGPT will reply to you in a confident way, but you don't know if it's just hallucinating or lying to you, right? Which might easily happen because it just does that, because it just may want to make you feel good about yourself, right? Great advice. I will put all the links you mentioned below so people can check it out. Yeah, I'm really happy to have you here, and I
Yeah,
will
me too.
pivot a little bit to the viewer now, say goodbye to them, but let's stay on the call so we can talk a bit later. All right. Okay, everyone, it's been great. Let me know if you have any questions or if you need any of the links maybe that I have not linked by the time I upload this. If you liked it, please leave a like. It helps a lot with the algorithms and help more people see topics like technical art, and it doesn't become so niche, hopefully. And yeah, in the comments, let me know what you think. And yeah, if you didn't like it, I don't know why you're here. And as always, Jack the journalist was here, and I say goodbye to all of you. See you on the next one.